This government believes these are questions they don't need to answer. We should just trust them implicitly, regardless of how many times they lie to us about keeping our health insurance if we like it, or exactly what the NSA may be doing in terms of spying on us, rather than our enemies. It is this arrogance and dishonesty that led to a major controversy over the government's infamous Jade Helm 15 training exercise this past summer. This was a gargantuan, multi-state military training exercise that involved war game operations on private land, in cities and towns, and in the countryside. Not only did American citizens see an unprecedented military presence in their midst, but covert agents were instructed to infiltrate civilian populations, identified only by armbands. According to the U.S. Army's own presentation, some participants will be wearing civilian attire and driving civilian vehicles. The government claimed this massive exercise was designed to get military personnel used to dealing with unfamiliar terrain and infiltrating civilian populations in other countries. Many speculated they were training for martial law during an emergency here. Let me be clear from the start. I never believed some of the wilder conspiracy theories about this exercise. I did not believe the federal government was planning to invade Texas or establish martial law. But I do have a problem with this and the media reaction to anyone who questioned it. First, I don't understand why such a massive military operation within our borders is necessary to train what is already the mightiest military force in human history. This is a military that hasn't lost a battle since early in World War II. If the administration is as committed as it says it is, not to put boots on the ground in any new conflict, then why do we need boots on the ground in seven U.S. states? Second, what precedent does this set? Not everyone who objects to this exercise believes it's a military coup d'etat, but there are legitimate concerns that conducting operations like this desensitizes civilian populations to a military presence in their midst. One of the bedrock principles of our free society is a suspicion of standing armies. It is especially disturbing that some of the trainees will be operating covertly. Regardless of what the pedantic academics running the current government might intend, it's fair to ask whether it would be easier for a future administration with more sinister intentions to oppress a population already accustomed to seeing military personnel and ordnance on American streets. What I find most disturbing about this is the media reaction. Just as they did with Pamela Geller and Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the majority of the media reflexively pounced on those standing up for freedom. Anyone who questioned the exercise for any reason was immediately lumped in with the most paranoid fringe elements and smeared as a kook. Most egregiously, the media often misrepresented what critics of the program said. CBS News, The Washington Post, and others all seemed to link by association the questions Alex Jones's InfoWars website raised about the program with a bizarre theory that closed Walmart stores were part of the conspiracy and would be used as prisons or death camps. There was only one problem. InfoWars had already publicly debunked that theory before the media implied Alex Jones endorsed it. It wasn't just the national media that smeared all dissenters to this overkill. The local alternative newspaper, Phoenix New Times, ran a story with the headline, "Jade Helm 15 Operation in Arizona by U.S. Army Worries Wackos." Can you believe that headline? I call attention to it only because it had the decency to publish updates from concerned citizens who disagreed with the writer. Here are some of the very sober, legitimate concerns of one local resident. Really wish you didn't disparage legitimate concerns with the term wacko. Set the knee-jerk conspiracy theorists aside for a moment. These operations are going to be held throughout towns and small businesses in the states specified. Go to the presentation made by the Jade Helm vendor to the Big Spring County Supervisors meeting in Texas and hear for yourself, YouTube. The citizens are supposed to notice the armbands worn by all of the participants, which will also include role-player volunteers when they see armed kidnappers, tanks, SWAT, etc. Think of the elderly, the children, and the uninformed. All I'm asking is that you take a mature, even-handed look at what is being foisted on the citizenry and the raw panic that has and will ensue as folks watch it unfold and keel over from a heart attack aka War of the Worlds. Remember? That was fake too, Ray. Does this person sound to you like a wacko? I encourage you to read the whole letter. The woman who wrote it was originally a New Yorker who was educated and had decades of top-level Fortune 100 experience. Not everyone who questions the government is sitting in his mother's basement wearing a tinfoil hat. Real everyday Americans are concerned about this exercise, and they have every right to be. Keep your mouth shut and obey. Any one of these stories, and the way they were reported, are cause enough for concern. We should be vigilant in guarding our liberties against even the slightest infringement. That's a core American value. Remember, the Boston Tea Party was about what would today be considered a minuscule tax. It was the principle that was important to our founders. Taken together, these stories and dozens of others like them constitute a pattern. It is Government Zero trampling liberties we once took for granted and replacing them with a new normal in American culture. Keep your mouth shut and obey. We've had a president who recognizes no constitutional limit on his power, and it's now trickled down to the cities and towns of America. If you criticize Islam or the president's refusal to recognize the new Holocaust, you're a bigot. If you criticize the welfare state, you're a racist. If you object to large-scale military training exercises on the streets of your town, you're a wacko. Meanwhile, the president is openly and admittedly seeking to control the media, just like Joseph Stalin or Chairman Mao. To a large extent, it looks like he's succeeded. Media outlets are being told how to report the war against ISIS, and none of them is allowed to send reporters to verify the administration's claims. They, too, are to just shut up and obey. Worst of all, the administration and like-minded gangs, posing as community groups, are waging an all-out war against local police that looks frighteningly similar to the war on local cops waged by Hitler. If you think you've seen police brutality, you haven't seen anything like what you might see when the entire nation is policed by an occupying army of federal police, ultimately answerable to one man or one woman. Government Zero means zero liberty. Chapter 12. Zero Police. Obama's Endgame: A Federal Police Force. After yet another city lay in flames, thanks to his divisive rhetoric and relentless war on local police, the grand illusionist in the White House had this to say. But we know that some communities have the odds stacked against them, and have had the odds stacked against them for a very long time, in some cases for decades. And in some communities, that sense of unfairness and powerlessness has contributed to dysfunction in those communities. Communities are like bodies, and if the immunity system is down, they can get sick. As usual, the president glosses over the violent crimes committed by rioters and looters, calling them dysfunction, while making excuses for the inexcusable mayhem perpetrated by the thugs. But that's just more of what we've heard from the Marxist-in-chief since he took office. What he proposes to do about the crisis he helped create is even worse. Obama is working around the clock in the remaining months of his reign of terror to make certain he destroys the soldiers of our immune system, the police. I'm something of an expert on immunity. I wrote a book on it back in the 1980s, during the height of the AIDS crisis. It was called Maximum Immunity and was published in 6 languages. It was a study of the immune system that compared white blood cells and other immune bodies that protect us against invaders to our soldiers, Marines, Navy, Coast Guard, and police. Obama knows very well that if you take down the immune system, a body can be destroyed. The invaders can take over and destroy the body politic. The president seems determined to destroy local police forces and replace them with federal police. I believe I was the first one to warn my listeners of this, but it doesn't matter who said it first. We can all see it now. He is unleashing community organizers on crime-ridden cities. This is a new mission. He's found $163 million to be distributed to gangs. He calls them community organizations, but in reality, they're gangs. What else can one call the Cincinnati Black United Front? How about the American Civil Liberties Union, The ACLU was a gang with law degrees. They're the cowardly side of the revolution. Obama's new attorney general is giving these groups money to tell local police how to behave. They're not going to be telling the police, "We back you, keep the gangs under control." No, they're going to be telling police, "Be careful how you treat the thugs, or you'll find yourself out of a job." I've told you many times that history repeats itself. It's repeating itself here in a very chilling way. Taking control of and nationalizing the local police was a hugely significant step for Hitler in consolidating his power. Let me be clear. I'm not saying Obama is Hitler. I've never said that. But he has all the dangerous instincts of a dictator. Nevertheless, what the Obama administration is doing to local police before our very eyes is horrifyingly similar to what Hitler did to create the Gestapo. Now, we know why he appointed Loretta Lynch to replace the worst attorney general in U.S. history. Lynch is worse than the worst. I told my listeners, Loretta Lynch would be worse than Eric Holder the minute I saw Al Sharpton demand she be made America's top cop. I was right. Her very first announcement after confirmation by the Senate confirmed this. Did she announce she was going to disarm the gangs in our cities? Did she say she'd target the communist front groups responsible for all of the violence and terrorism in our streets? No. Instead, Loretta Lynch announced she was going to hand out $163 million to thuggish groups like the ACLU, who will work with the actual street thugs to do the damage. Lynch is going to dictate new guidelines to teach local police how to deal with gangs. This is very similar to how the Gestapo was born. Upon becoming chancellor, Adolf Hitler appointed Hermann Göring, Minister of the Interior for Prussia. This gave Göring control of the police. His position was roughly parallel to our U.S. Attorney General, although Loretta Lynch doesn't have control of our local police. That's because we have a federal constitution and state governments, which are supposed to function separately to avoid a dictatorship. State and local governments are supposed to carry out the majority of the police work in the United States. Unfortunately, we have a madman surrounded by demagogues in the White House. They want to take over every aspect of our lives, and checks on their power, like the state governments and local police forces, stand in their way. Hitler was actually a fierce opponent of what we would call states' rights, as are all dictators. As was reported at the time, under the impact of the Nazi Revolution, Hitler was able to go much farther than the most sanguine had dared to dream. Politically speaking, Prussia, Bavaria, and other once proud kingdoms have ceased to lead an independent existence. One will, that of Hitler, now extends from Berlin to the farthest corners of the Reich. One will is what it's really all about. That's what a dictator is. One who seeks to run an entire nation according to his will alone, rather than through powers delegated by the people, to exercise the will of the people. You might say Hitler ruled Germany with his pen and his phone, although there were much more brutal consequences for anyone who resisted than there are in the United States today, at least so far. Hitler also created the first national health insurance program in a non-communist state. Just like Obamacare, this was more about consolidating power and attacking capitalism than providing better health care for the poor and lower middle class. Helping the poor was just the sales pitch. Let's not forget Hitler was a socialist. Nazi is just a shortened version of his party's name, the National Socialist Party. Just like Americans today, Germans at the time were blissfully ignorant that Hitler's attacks on states' rights and free enterprise and health care had anything to do with their personal liberty until it was too late. That was when Hitler launched his war on local police. It was directly prosecuted by Hermann Göring. It started when Göring prohibited the official local police from interfering with Nazi brown shirts. The brown shirts were officially known as the Sturmabteilung, or SA, which means storm detachment. They were Hitler's paramilitary group, which he had employed to intimidate opposition for over a decade by the time he came to power. Their modus operandi was to inflict violence in the streets against the Nazis' political opponents. This had the dual effect of eliminating official opposition directly and terrorizing the populace through the violence. The gangs that burned down Baltimore and riot in cities across America with their protests are today's brown shirts. They may not be acting under the government's direction, but they have the same effect on the populace, and they get a pass from the government after the fact. They destroyed Ferguson, Missouri, and got away with it. They burned businesses and other property in Baltimore and got away with that too. They had the president covering for them, just as Hitler and Goering backed the brown shirts. They own the streets of Oakland, California. Goering's support of the brown shirts and neutering of the local police left German citizens defenseless, just as law-abiding citizens are defenseless in American cities today when the rioting starts. The brown shirts also looted local businesses, just as the rioters in Ferguson, Oakland, and Baltimore looted. Goering was more ruthless in his attack on police than our dear leader wants to appear. He simply purged 50,000 local police who didn't toe the Nazi party line and replaced them with deputized brown shirts. Once these street thugs had the power to arrest people, jails overflowed and more space was needed to accommodate the huge increase in prisoners. Thus, the concentration camp system was born. Fraulein Lynch might not get away with anything as overtly dictatorial as Goering's purge, but she very well could accomplish the same ends through different means. We've already seen a blueprint for purging local police with Obama's purge of the military after Benghazi. Once community groups begin advising local police departments, watch for a parade of cops with productive records being dismissed or put on administrative leave for petty violations of the new politically driven code of conduct. It will be the same game plan used by the grand deceiver to purge the military of top-ranked opponents. The purges would likely enjoy public support, given the all-out propaganda campaign being waged against local police. This isn't just my opinion. Former NYPD Commissioner Howard Safer sees it the same way. After 20 years of incredible crime reduction, accomplished by thousands of dedicated police officers, the public has become complacent now that they are safer, said Safer, who led the nation's largest police department from 1996 to 2000. They have let the anti-police pundits and talking heads convince everyone from the president to the attorney general that police are racist and brutal. The American Council on Public Safety, ACPS, also recognizes what is going on. In a press release following a speech by the president in May, they said, "The president has chosen to politicize and endanger the safety of our nation's police officers. Instead of leading America towards reconciliation or strengthening community policing, the president has again opted to propose policies that place blame on police for unrest while weakening their ability to defend themselves and protect communities. As the blood of police officers runs in the streets, the president seems intent to embolden those who drive the false narrative that our nation's cops, not the criminals, are the problem." All of this has resulted in an increase in line-of-duty deaths for police officers. Just like Hitler's brown shirts, Obama's brown shirts have responded without specific instruction to assist the purge in brutal fashion. That may not be the president's intent, but it is a consequence of his deplorable responses to the riots. The number of cops killed in the line of duty nearly doubled to 59 in 2014. That's a number that had been dropping for decades until last year. The war on local police and eventual takeover of policing communities by the national government is how the Gestapo was born in Germany. It's also how Obama is giving birth to a new Gestapo in America. He's just doing it more subtly. His rioting gangs are called victims. The police are called thugs. He's reversed everything. He's legitimized mayhem like we've seen in city after city, blamed the cops, and now wants to take national control of them as the solution. Obama's brown shirts don't have the power to arrest cops themselves, but the federally funded spies sent to oversee them will accomplish the same result by reporting them for their treatment of the thugs burning down our cities. Once the precedent is set that local cops can be removed based on information the federally subsidized gangs like the ACLU provide about them, There could be a parade of cops thrown out of their jobs and replaced with useless political hacks who are properly sympathetic to the criminals setting businesses on fire. Then, law-abiding citizens in America will be as defenseless as law-abiding Germans in 1930s Germany. Then they'll be sufficiently terrorized to support a proposal for a national police force. That's the end game. We've already seen the mayhem start to shift from mainly destruction of property to assaults on innocent citizens. Protesters in Cleveland pepper-sprayed bystanders sitting at outdoor tables in restaurants. Let's not forget how bad it can get. During the 1992 LA riots, innocent motorists were pulled from their cars and murdered. That was with a real president in the White House, which wasn't tacitly condoning the violence. Barack Obama is the greatest illusionist in the history of the presidency. Make no mistake, he's a grand illusionist. Instead of screaming in German, he speaks softly in English, but threatens everyone in the United States of America with his reign of terror on a daily basis. Meanwhile, ISIS is taking over one city after another in Iraq, and Obama's sorority tell us they're not losing any sleep over it. The world is burning, and they are attacking American police. Let's get back to history for a moment. After taking complete control of the local police, Göring created the Geheime Staatspolizei, shortened to Gestapo for convenience. The Prussian police had done Göring an unintentional favor by creating a huge cache of secret files on the Nazis. Göring took that idea and ran with it. He not only used the existing Prussian files against any internal Nazi opponents, but had his Gestapo continue the practice against everyone. Do you remember those FBI files the Clinton administration requested and received back in the 1990s? Maybe those are the secret files that are keeping Republicans silent today, while the progressives tear down this nation. It's possible, although the Obama administration wouldn't need 20-year-old paper files to blackmail Republicans or anyone else today. It has the NSA, collecting metadata on every phone call and email sent by anyone in this country, despite a federal court ruling the practice illegal earlier this year. Or maybe the Republicans are just greedy cowards who aren't interested in going out of their way to oppose the president on his terrifying mission. We know the establishment Republicans are willing to sell out our freedom. We saw that when Mitch McConnell tried to ram through renewal of the Patriot Act and defended the NSA's bulk collection of metadata without warrants or probable cause. Either way, we're on a very dangerous road that America wouldn't be the first to travel. With free speech and freedom of the press under attack, the military scaring the daylights out of civilians with massive training exercises in our cities and towns, and a president giving tacit support to nascent brown shirts in our midst, the local police are our last line of defense. They are our antibodies against the disease of chaos and destruction invading our body politic. That's why the progressives are trying to destroy them. Chapter 13. Saving a Nation with Nationalism. Abandoning Conservatism. I know you've sought out this book for answers. I'm going to give you answers, but perhaps not the ones you expect. Extraordinary problems require extraordinary solutions. A nation that has been radically changed for the worse may need to be radically changed back to its best form. It's time to abandon conservatism as the defining principle of our movement. It has become meaningless. Conservative has come to mean anything anyone who joins the Republican Party says it means. It means small government to one person and big government to another. It means military interventionism to one and isolationism to another. It is nationalism to one and internationalism to another. Any movement that could include Jeb Bush, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, and Ben Carson isn't a movement at all. It has no defining principles. It is merely a buoy in the ocean to cling to while gainsaying the other side. We've tried that approach in election after election. It hasn't worked. The progressive juggernaut continues to swamp us while radical Islam attempts to finish us off. Don't get me wrong. I remain as much a conservative as I've ever been, in the true sense of the word. I seek to conserve those long-standing social and legal traditions that have protected our individual liberty and national greatness for hundreds of years. That's what conservatism really means in the classic sense. But when Jeb Bush can promote Common Core in our schools, open borders, and Spanish as a second American language, and call it conservatism, the word has lost its meaning, just as liberal has. At one time, liberal meant laissez-faire capitalism, limited government and personal property. While I believe in each of those principles, they are missing one important component that makes the rest of them possible. Duty. Liberty and prosperity are not possible without commitment to preserve and defend the nation without which their existence is impossible. I'm not talking about being enslaved to the government. I'm talking about responsibility to the nation. The nation and the government are not the same thing. That's what the progressives don't understand. Our forefathers pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to each other, not to any government. The government is just a tool. It can be a means toward preserving the nation or destroying it. I don't think I have to tell you how it's been used for as long as you or I can remember. Decade after decade, the progressives have chipped away at those traditions that defined America as different from every other nation in history. Then the Obama administration came in and replaced the chisels with bulldozers. To counter that, we offered Mitt Romney. Romney is a fine man and loves this country, but he obviously wasn't the answer. He offered what amounted to light progressivism. He wanted to keep the good parts of Obamacare. He wanted to blow up the education bubble even further, just as Obama did. He supported NSA spying and even Obama's horrifying claim that he can kill an American citizen on American soil on his own authority. In spite of these positions, he was deemed too conservative by the electorate. That's why I say the word has no meaning anymore. True conservatives know what it means, but they didn't come out to vote for Romney. They won't come out to vote for another light progressive like Jeb Bush either. Besides, what good does it do to elect him? We already had light progressivism with his brother. Jeb is even more progressive than George W. We need a fundamental political alteration of the monopoly game. I've been saying we need a nationalist candidate for years. Real Americans are starving for one. If a truly nationalist candidate ran as a Republican, he would win the nomination and the general election by a landslide. But if we're going to put a nationalist candidate forward, we need to know what he or she would look like. Nationalism versus conservatism. Conservatism has come to mean almost nothing other than pro-business. Those who call themselves conservatives today have adopted the laissez-faire rhetoric of the old, classical liberals. But they don't really want laissez-faire. They don't propose to dismantle the massive regulatory structure built up by progressives over the past century and allow true laissez-faire competition. Instead, they seek to tweak regulations, create loopholes, and bestow targeted tax cuts to allow their corporate donors, that is, masters, to make bigger profits while remaining insulated from new competition by the remaining regulations and taxes. The problem is, these corporations are not American anymore. They are multinational entities with no incentive to be loyal to any particular nation unless they are given one. The Republican Party and most of those within it, who identify as conservative, don't propose to do that. That's why they backed NAFTA 20 years ago, and back the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, today. As far as they're concerned, what is good for big business is an end in and of itself. This is why the Reagan approach didn't work. Reagan was another fundamentally decent leader and much more authentically conservative than anyone we've seen since. But he was missing that one element that might have made his system successful. True nationalism. Reagan rejected the idiotic socialist policies that had dominated American policy for decades and was successful in reviving economic growth. He just didn't incorporate the kind of nationalist policies that would have prevented the wholesale sellout that occurred under Clinton with Republican support. Don't get me wrong, I wholeheartedly believe in a free market economy in which each individual keeps the fruits of his labor and competition determines the winners and losers. But I also recognize, as true conservatives have throughout American history, that the entire world is not a free market. That was why traditional conservatives gave the federal government the power to regulate trade. It wasn't so the government could stick its nose into the minute details of every business in America. It was to defend and preserve the conditions within which Americans could interact freely with each other and remain competitive with the rest of the world. If the world economy consisted of 190 or so countries, just like the United States, a laissez-faire approach on the world stage would be just fine. Perhaps someday that will be true. But here in the real world today, there are not 190 USAs. There's only one, which provides the personal and economic liberty that has made America so prosperous. America's uniqueness is what has led to a standard of living unrivaled in the annals of recorded history, with opportunity found nowhere else in the world. That's why it is not realistic to expect American workers to compete with Chinese workers kept in a state of poverty by political oppression, currency manipulation, and state capitalism. The only way for them to do that would be to accept the low standard of living that goes along with those conditions in China. That's what the progressives argue conservatives want. It's hard to disagree with them when the Republican Party wholeheartedly supports our internationalist president on trade deals like the TPP. Traditional conservatives were also nationalists, from Alexander Hamilton to Henry Clay to Abraham Lincoln. Conservatives have always staunchly believed in economic policies that were best for America. When the Republican Party was born, its platform included higher taxes. Lincoln was a former Whig who believed in high tariffs to protect American business from longer-established foreign competition. Lincoln and the Republicans also believed the government had a responsibility to provide the infrastructure necessary for a modern economy to flourish. He wanted to subsidize roads, railroads, and other infrastructure. Contrast that with the Republican reaction to the Amtrak disaster earlier this year. All they were concerned about was using the tragedy for political gain. From listening to them, you'd think they don't believe the government should even build roads. That's not traditional conservatism, and it's certainly not nationalism. A nationalist candidate would recognize there is a very specific role for the government. It is not to centrally plan or control every aspect of economic activity, as the progressives believe. It is not to redistribute wealth, but it is to maintain an environment in which a market economy can operate and provide the public goods needed to maximize the efficiency of that economy. It is to protect we the people from foreign powers buying and selling our infrastructure, transporting our manufacturing base, and dumping cheap goods on us to drive small and medium-sized business into bankruptcy. After the Amtrak wreck, Republicans immediately negated the fact that the infrastructure of this country is crumbling, despite trillions spent on stimulus. Where did those trillions go? Certainly not into new Hoover dams, Golden Gate bridges, Lincoln tunnels, Empire State buildings, or even highways. The taxpayer money collected to rebuild America was stolen. That's just corruption, not necessarily progressivism. True nationalist conservatives shouldn't be arguing that we don't need any government infrastructure. We need honest government, like the kind that built the America we are now letting fall into disrepair. Nationalist immigration. Regardless of which party has been in power, illegal aliens have flooded over our border. I've talked about why the progressives have allowed this. It's part of their agenda. They want to transform America from a constitutional republic based on English common law traditions, Judeo-Christian values, and Western European customs, into a secular social democracy based on atheism, multiculturalism, and Marxist economic principles. That Mexican immigrants are more socially conservative and devoted to God, family, and a strong work ethic might be one reason why the Obama administration is bringing in far more Muslims, Asians, and Caribbean Islanders than he is Hispanics. While all immigrants, including Hispanics, tend to vote Democrat, Muslim immigrants are far less likely to assimilate into American culture than Hispanics. As we've seen, Muslim refugees in particular have completely refused to assimilate, forming self-contained Muslim communities like Little Mogadishu in Minnesota, in which potential sleeper cells are constantly being formed. None of this would come as a shock to most conservative voters, even if they hadn't listened to this audiobook. What they didn't understand is why the Republican Party, even when they held the White House, Senate, and House of Representatives for 6 straight years, failed to even slow down the flood of illegal immigrants. Knowing why the progressives are desperate to get them in and eventually give them the vote, knowing that even legal immigrants vote Democrat, why would they not act in their self-interest and stop it? The answer is the same as for why they support a lopsided trade deal. They're not a nationalist party. They are simply a pro-business party, and low-skilled immigrants provide a source of cheap labor for their corporate supporters. They are so bought and sold by these special interests that they will actually stand by and watch their own demographic destruction before doing anything that might shave a penny off next year's corporate profits. This is why Larry Ellison, one of the world's richest men, supports Marco Rubio, a shallow man willing to open the floodgates to as many H-1B visas as possible, permitting Ellison, Zuckerberg, and Gates to bring in more foreign tech workers just to lower their labor costs. I have no particular attachment to the Republican Party, outside of their usefulness in stopping the progressive Islamists. Unfortunately, they are going to take all of us down with them by not resisting the single greatest threat to our borders, language, and culture: indiscriminate, unregulated immigration. So, what would a nationalist immigration policy look like? It certainly wouldn't be closed borders forever. Immigration is not an all-or-nothing proposition. Neither am I arguing for a lower number of immigrants per se. It's more about who is allowed to enter the United States and why. Immigration policies today bring in people based upon what America can do for them. A nationalist immigration policy would completely reverse this approach and make decisions on whom to admit based on what they can do for America. Does that mean we never take in refugees, or those seeking a better life in America than is available in their home country? Absolutely not. When you think about it, nobody seeks to immigrate unless the opportunities here are better than at home. But there is a finite number of people who can be admitted into the country in any given year, regardless of how efficiently the government agencies work. That means there are choices to make on who to admit and who we cannot admit, at least for now. We've had a radically liberal immigration policy for decades. We may need drastically opposite measures before we get back to normal. Nationalist liberals. I often ask friends if they believe there is any chance to work within the Democratic Party. Unsurprisingly, the overwhelming majority of answers amount to a resounding no. I understand why well-meaning patriots feel this way. Certainly, there is not much chance to work with the leading Democratic politicians. They subscribe to an ideology diametrically opposed to everything we stand for. Trying to enlist them to help save our borders, language, and culture would be like trying to transform lions into vegetarians. It's just not going to happen. Democratic voters are another story. Certainly, there is a large percentage of Democratic voters who are so dependent upon the government, or so anti-American, that they will never join our cause. They are committed to achieving everything we are committed to stopping. But I don't believe they are the majority. Rather, they are an active, vocal minority whose radical beliefs get the airplay, while the majority of Democratic voters are simply voting for what they believe is the lesser of two evils, just as we are. I believe a nationalist movement would attract what is either a majority or a significant minority of Democratic voters, who are not socialists, and who do not seek to destroy society and remake it in a progressive image. I believe this group of Democrats who identify as liberal simply do not see in the Republican Party as it exists today a recognition of the individual's responsibility to society that is so vital a part of a nationalist movement. I don't blame them. I don't see it either. This group simply places more emphasis on the individual's responsibility to community and nation than on economic freedom. Given the choice between the conservative movement, as they understand it today, and the progressives, they side with the latter, who at least acknowledge some public responsibility. I believe a nationalist movement would attract large numbers of this group. They are blue-collar Democrats who aren't interested in socialism or forced multiculturalism. They just don't want to live in an America where they are completely sold out to multinational corporations who have no obligation to the nation they are helping to build. They want to live in the kind of America their parents and grandparents grew up in, where there is economic freedom, opportunity, and personal liberty, tempered by a duty to preserve the nation that makes all of that possible. Once they understand the nationalist platform, I believe many of them will join us without hesitation. Nationalist Foreign Policy. When George W. Bush invaded Afghanistan, he had overwhelming support from the public, regardless of political affiliation. America had been attacked, and no one denied the need to defend our security and defeat the forces behind 9/11. It was only when Bush apparently abandoned that mission and pursued his disastrous invasion of Iraq that rank-and-file Democrats turned against him. It was largely the Iraq War that cost Bush and the Republicans Congress in 2006 and the White House in 2008. To this day, Republicans refuse to admit the Iraq War was a mistake, merely because it was prosecuted by a Republican, even though the rest of the world, including almost half of Republican voters, know it. I was against the Iraq War from the beginning, for the same reason true conservatives and most rank-and-file Democrats were. It did not defend the security of the United States against anyone who threatened it. Whatever secondary reasons there may have been for invading Iraq beneath the ridiculous weapons of mass destruction theory, none of them justified sending our troops to war or the sacrifice of blood and treasure that resulted. Yet today, most Americans would support military action in Iraq against ISIS, and they disapprove of President Obama's handling of the Islamic State. Why the completely opposite opinions on military action in the same country? Because the American people perceive a real threat from ISIS today that they did not perceive from Saddam Hussein in 2003. I believe history will show the people were wise on both accounts. If we had a government that truly represented them, we would likely have avoided the mistake of invading Iraq in 2003 and the mistake of letting ISIS continue to grow its power in 2015. The truth is, the Republican Party has become far too eager to go to war for its own sake. I don't think it's any accident that this benefits the big business of defense contractors. The Republicans want to go to war over everything, all the time. The American people want war limited to defending our security. Meanwhile, the progressives have sent our troops into conflicts like Somalia and Serbia, either to support the Islamofascists or on humanitarian missions. At the time of this writing, the Obama administration has signaled that it was prepared to expand military cooperation in the fight against Boko Haram. It's no coincidence that America's progressive Islamist administration would suddenly want to fight the ISIS affiliate Boko Haram in Nigeria the minute the conservative, free market-oriented People's Democratic Party and its Christian president lost an election to the progressive party of Muslim Muhammad Buhari, Nigeria's former military dictator. Until this election, the administration had expressed little interest in the Nigerians' plight. Regardless, this fight has nothing to do with the national security of the United States, nor the stability of the world. The peaceful transfer of power was the first in Nigeria in decades and represents a step forward in stability, if not in the best interests of the Nigerian people. That's their problem. American taxpayers are not financially responsible for it, and sending our troops into such quagmires, should it come to that, further weakens our military. Most Americans, whether they vote Republican or Democrat, want our military to be used only when it is necessary for our national defense. They don't want to sacrifice lives or treasure to right every wrong in the world or promote democracy in third world backwaters, whose inhabitants burn our flag. When the military is deployed, they want them given the tools and strategy they need to win decisively and come back home. In other words, they want a nationalist approach to foreign policy. 40 Actions to Save America. In terms of specific actions, I could probably think of thousands that would spring from a nationalist movement to save this country. I've proposed many over the years. Some were time-sensitive. Some can still be accomplished. I have other ideas that are brand new. Here are the top 40 that come to my mind as most urgent in 2015 to 2016. Notice that not all of these have to do with the federal government. Some should be accomplished at the state or local levels. Some should be accomplished outside of any governments at all. There is much we can do in the private sector with the choices we make and the power we have over those who want to influence those choices. 1. Start a nationalist party. We need a true two-party system. Right now, we have a one-party system. It's a charade, a shell game with no peas under either shell. As we have seen with Boehner and McConnell, we have an oligarchy running America. We voted in conservatives, and they were put at the back of the bus. Conservative has become meaningless. A nationalist party would attract disaffected members from both parties and tip the balance of power back to the people. 2. Close the borders completely for 7 years. We have had unprecedented immigration into this country, not just in terms of numbers, but of foreign and even hostile cultures. We need time to assimilate the immigrants we have, just as we did the waves of immigrants at the beginning of the last century. At the end of 7 years, evaluate our capacity for normalizing immigration with nationalist priorities, as I've described. 3. Deport all illegal aliens in American prisons. That would be up to one-third of the prison population, which exceeds 2 million prisoners. This is not an expense American taxpayers should be bearing, especially in a down economy. 4. Repeal the Anchor Babies Law. Right now, an illegal alien who crosses our border and gives birth has automatically bestowed citizenship on her offspring. This gives an incentive for illegal immigration, not to mention endangering the mother and baby. 5. Make English the official language of the United States. Mandate English for all legal and political transactions, including ballots. If you can't read English, you can't vote, period. Require all government employees to be able to speak, read, and write English fluently. 6. Require government-issued identification to vote. This seems like a no-brainer. It doesn't guarantee the voter is a citizen, but it at least confirms he or she is alive. Dead voters overwhelmingly vote progressive. 7. Reintroduce civics classes to elementary and secondary schools. We need to teach our children the history and meaning of America's founding fathers, founding documents, and founding principles. This knowledge should also be required on all citizenship tests. 8. Restore to active duty all military officers purged by Obama. Offer them a generous bonus as an incentive to return. 9. Restore physical standards in the military. If women are going to participate in combat, they are going to have to be able to meet the same physical standards as men. We cannot weaken our military for the sake of progressive politics. Lower standards cost lives on the battlefield. 10. Restructure military spending. We need to adequately equip the soldiers who are defending our civilization and stop wasting defense dollars in Germany and South Korea. Pull our troops out of those countries and redeploy them on our southern border. This will help control illegal immigration and ensure that soldiers are patronizing American retailers and businesses instead of foreign ones. Use some of the savings to increase the pay and upgrade the equipment of soldiers on the front lines of the war on radical Islam. 11. Cut the rest of government significantly. While our military is struggling, the rest of the meddling federal government is living higher than ever. Cut all non-military spending in each department by 4% per year over the next presidential term, for a total reduction of 16% by 2021. 12. Repair our relations with Russia. Russia should be an ally in the war against radical Islam and a partner in the world economy. The United States should propose an agreement that has Russia cease any aggression outside its borders in return for assurance that the U.S. and Europe will stay out of the affairs of nations bordering Russia. 13. Sign a mutual defense treaty with Israel. The United States has no formal treaty with Israel at present. The U.S. would pledge its protection if Israel were attacked by a foreign power in return for Israel guaranteeing the safety of American shipping and trade with its own resources in the region. 14. End all foreign aid, including to Israel. The U.S. currently gives $3 billion in annual military aid to Israel, and 5 times that amount to Middle Eastern nations, most of which want to destroy Israel. We can't afford this, nor would we need to bribe other nations not to attack Israel with a formal mutual defense treaty in place. 15. recognize radical Islam as the enemy. We aren't fighting a war on terrorism. Terrorism is a minor problem outside of what is perpetrated by radical Islam. Let's formally recognize the enemy, who doesn't just fight on the battlefield and in terrorist acts, but seeks to infiltrate the West and destroy its borders, language, and culture. 16. Allow profiling in security investigations. While the TSA is harassing a Welsh-German grandmother from Indiana, radical Islamists walk onto airplanes without identification and try to blow them up. This is the insane result of banning profiling in security work. The security risks to American citizens come from radical Islamists. They have openly declared their intentions. Let's start our investigations on terrorist plots there and stop harassing innocent Americans. 17. Demand Congress declare war against ISIS and destroy them. ISIS claims to be a formal state. They control territory, have declared war on the United States, and have killed American citizens. This is a no-brainer. Declare war and win it decisively. The rules of engagement should go no further than what is required by the Geneva Conventions. 18. Close all tax loopholes for Hollywood. Hollywood has become a fountain of anti-Americanism and has tax incentives to keep churning out the garbage it has been creating. Close them. Let them survive without the government's help. 19. Fund all climate science research to include the skeptics. This branch of science has become completely politicized. The reason so many scientists are willing to go along with this preposterous theory is they are dependent upon government money. Balance the funding, and we'll see a sudden uptick in skepticism about the real effects of man's activities on climate. 20. Withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if possible. We don't know the terms of Obama's secret trade deal. If there is a way to withdraw honorably under its terms, the next president should get out of it. 21. Withdraw from NAFTA. It has benefited no one but multinational corporations. In addition to killing American manufacturing, it has also destroyed the small farm industry in Mexico, giving further incentive for illegal immigration. 22. Narrow the Federal Reserve's mandate to a strong dollar and stable prices. Right now, the central bank is also charged with maximizing employment, managing long-term interest rates, and regulating banks. It's doing none of its jobs well. Its mandate to maximize employment requires it to inflate the currency, which contradicts its mandate to keep prices stable. As we aren't getting real employment growth anyway, we have nothing to lose. 23. End the H-1B visa program. We have STEM workers unemployed and ready to start tomorrow. We don't need to bring in temporary help from other countries. Big business will have to pay the market rate here in the United States. 24. Institute a flat tax. Right now, almost half of U.S. citizens pay no income tax at all, while the other half pays progressively more as they become more productive. This is unfair and counterproductive by definition. A 15% flat tax on everyone means everyone pays their fair share, as the progressives love to say. It also eliminates myriad loopholes for all sorts of special interests, including corporate America and Hollywood. 25. Reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. This 1933 law prohibited commercial banks from also operating as investment banks. Its repeal in 1999 was a key factor in the housing meltdown. Here's one regulation that actually helped. Restore it. 26. Reinstate the Wall Street uptick rule. This rule required short sales to be made on an uptick or at a price higher than the last traded price when the last movement was upward. It sounds technical, but it basically prevents speculators from driving stock prices down purely for short-term gain. Wall Street provides a valuable service when it capitalizes new businesses, creating jobs and wealth. This rule helped keep it focused on that, instead of functioning as a rigged casino for speculators. 27. Privatize the regulation of Wall Street. There is a role for government regulation and a role for the market. Clearly, Congress is never going to regulate the source of its campaign contributions. Create a financial clearinghouse for the oversight of financial derivative debt instruments. together with prohibitions on bailouts, this would introduce market discipline to the legalized gambling. 28. Institute tort reform. Frivolous lawsuits and ridiculously disproportionate awards also drive up medical expenses. States should cap medical liability at $250,000 per claim. This is one thing my home state of California did right, and it worked. 29. Eliminate government employee pensions. The pension is an outdated concept that never really worked. Virtually no one in the private sector is guaranteed a pension by their employer. Why should government employees receive them? Existing pensions must be renegotiated to reflect economic reality. 30. End affirmative action. We've had a black president, black cabinet members from both parties, a black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, black CEOs of Fortune 100 corporations, and black billionaires. None of these achieved their success through affirmative action. Affirmative action is racism defined, as it assumes people of color need special privileges to make it. Clearly, black Americans have proved they don't. It's time to kill it. 31. Defund federal unemployment benefits. Unemployment benefits should be provided by private insurers in state markets. Just as we don't want states to prohibit interstate competition in medical insurance, we don't want the federal government subsidizing unemployment. It encourages people not to work. At the time of this writing, we had a record number of job openings in America. We need to incentivize people to get back to work. 32. Limit welfare benefits. Limit welfare benefits to 3 years and end the incentive for welfare moms to have more babies by capping the subsidies per child. We need to reverse the perverse incentive for people to have more children when they can't support the ones they already have. 33. End bulk collection of data by the NSA. The NSA was collecting data on every American. The USA Freedom Act reformed this practice, but it didn't go far enough. We are wasting time and resources on innocent Americans. We know who the enemy is. Get warrants on radical Islamists and stop spying on the rest of us. 34. Make all state universities and colleges free speech zones. Our colleges and universities have become brainwashing centers for the progressive left, where no dissenting speech is permitted. Not only does it further the progressive Islamist agenda, it stifles creativity and critical thinking. Tax dollars should not be subsidizing subversion. 35. Defend freedom of speech against radical Islam. Americans should feel as secure in their right to criticize Islam as they are in their right to criticize any other religion. Oppose government infringement of this right. And when the news media supports it, boycott their broadcasts. They need our viewership, but we no longer need them. 36. Restore freedom of religion in the military. Stop persecuting qualified officers and soldiers for their religious beliefs. End the war on Christianity in the military. 37. Defend religious freedom in business. Regardless of gay marriage laws, individuals should not be compelled to violate their conscience on matters of religion. Support religious freedom restoration acts at the state level. 38. Restore religious freedom in schools. The First Amendment guarantees freedom of religion, not freedom from religion. No religion should be officially promoted in schools, but students and teachers should be free to talk about their religious beliefs without imposing them on others. 39. Defend freedom of the press. Oppose any intimidation of the press for unfavorable reporting on the government, regardless of which party is in power. Reward media that challenges the government with your business. Boycott media that bends to the pressure and propagandizes for the government. 40. Oppose military exercises in our cities and towns. We have the most powerful military in the history of the world, all of Obama's efforts to weaken it notwithstanding. We do not need them training in our midst, especially doing covert operations in which red states are characterized as hostile. We should refuse our consent to the participation operations like Jade Helm 15 require. I chose to put defense of our liberties at the end of the list because it is the last thing I want you to remember. Let's not forget that freedom is the most precious jewel in the crown of our culture. it is more important than prosperity or power. Without freedom, there can be no real virtue and no enjoyment of prosperity. This list is only a beginning. It is a jumping-off point from which to launch a nationalist movement to restore the America that was the light of the world and build an even better one for the future. Epilogue. Don't give up hope. The trouble with those who care is that caring in the face of times like these can drive them insane. I know our fight can seem hopeless at times, but it isn't. I truly believe good will win in the end. One of the best reasons for hope is the millions of college students out there who love their country despite all the forces trying to corrupt them. I ran a contest on my radio program earlier this year asking young people to write an essay called "What Does It Mean to Be an American?" Of the 1,700 essays submitted, the five best essayists will each receive a $20,000 scholarship to the college of their choice. The winning essays can be found on my website, http://www.michaelsavage.wnd.com/2015/07/here-r-the-winning-essays-in-the-savage-scholarship-contest/. Reading them will give you hope. They certainly did so for me. This has been a Hachette audio production of Government Zero. No borders, no language, no culture. Written by Michael Savage. Read by Barry Bear. Produced by Cheryl Smith. Directed by Jared O'Connell. Post-production by Beat Street Productions. Government Zero is also available in print and digital formats from Center Street, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by Michael Savage. Audio production copyright 2015 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.